I want to start this talk and by just saying how pleased I am to be talking in the centre here. I have done a talk here before, but I can't quite remember when it was. It was quite a long time ago. And I was very glad to be asked to come and do it. Singer Darkany was quite persistent in getting me to come, and I'm very glad that she did persist. I mean, it does seem ridiculous that I just live down the road and in Sirlingham and haven't come here that often. That's my loss. And I want to start getting into this talk about the refuge tree, which I gather is going to be the whole theme of Sangha Night for a while, looking at the refuge tree. But I want to get into it by going back to the Buddha. Going back to the Buddha teaching in northern India. And it was interesting just sitting in the room here just before we started and just looking up at these lovely beams. And this is such a lovely, intimate space. It got me in mind of a story of the Buddha actually in his last days, where he's described as sitting in this, well, it's the sort of village hall. I think it might have even been a place called the Brick Hall. You know, would have been unusual, a brick building. But it describes the Buddha leaning against the central post of this building. Presumably, it's thatched and with beams above. And he sits up all night communicating the Dharma to all the village people. So it wouldn't have just been his bhikshu and bhikshuni disciples, his full timers. It would be the village people, if you like, the so-called ordinary people. And it was particularly a Dharma teaching for them. And he stays up all night communicating. This is an old man of 80, leaning against a wooden post, just talking, unfolding the Dharma. And, you know, very often when you read the old texts, they can seem very kind of stereotypical, even formulaic. But I like to imagine that the Buddha is actually talking about the Dharma in a way that is really to do with everyday people's, everyday persons' concerns, wherever they are, whatever they happen to be doing, really getting that across. But imagine that, an all-night Dharma teaching session with the Buddha. Don't worry, I won't try and emulate the Buddha. I haven't got a post to lean against, and I'm not that good. But this is the kind of thing you find time and time again in the life of the Buddha. The life of the Buddha is a record of communications, a record of this man meeting people. Sometimes it will be a formal Dharma discourse. He will be sitting there. He'll be giving a lecture. Going through various topics. A crowd will be gathered around, the community will be around him, and it will be a very formal exposition of his teaching. At other times, it might be a chance meeting, a meeting with a farmer, a meeting with a housewife, a meeting with a kind of freelance religious so-called wanderer, a businessman. They haven't necessarily even thought about leading any kind of Dharma life, any kind of spiritual life. They just bump into this wandering man in his patched rag robe, and a communication ensues. And very often, the records of the texts, you know, tell us that the communication that they have with the Buddha is very, very profound indeed. It's not just to do, of course, with what the Buddha is saying, although that is very important, the actual content of the teaching. But, of course, it's the presence. It's the presence of this great man, this great teacher. He is, of course, just being himself. He's just being his enlightened self. But you have to imagine what it must have been like to encounter this man, somebody who is just extraordinarily mindful. You get these descriptions of sometimes of people, what people see when they see the Buddha, and they see this person of incredible sort of poise, And dignity. And, you know, when you think of mindfulness, sometimes people try to do mindfulness and they end up looking like a robot. It's very unattractive, very unappealing. But the Buddha's mindfulness is perfectly natural. If you like, his mindfulness, his consciousness is just completely perfuming. His awareness is completely perfuming all of his experience. So there's this extraordinary, natural sense of presence. And the Buddha was very often seeing people that saw him, and he was very, very beautiful to people. Very, very beautiful. Even when he's an old man, there's this extraordinary kind of beauty about him, a kind of glow, a kind of radiance about him. He would have been very lean. He would have been, you know, probably quite brown as well. The traditional depictions of sort of a golden figure with a bump on their head, that isn't really what it would have been like. Sometimes he would have been quite unshaven. Sometimes in the Buddha's day, he and his disciples, they wouldn't have shaved for weeks and weeks and weeks. So you might have come across a sort of grizzly, you know, looking Buddha. But he would have been very, very attractive, very magnetic. Not to everybody. You know, some people would see him and abuse him and, you know, call him a shave pate and, you know, just a beggar. Why have you come here? And so on and so forth. But there was this fascinating kind of quality about the Buddha, so much so that he was accused in the very early days of his teaching of seducing away the young men and women from their families to lead a full-time Dharma life and through magic spells and things like that. But of course it wasn't that. It was this kind of, you know, this magnetic quality of enlightenment, of an enlightened being, of a being who sees things as they are, who's fully in touch naturally with the way things are, and who is kindly, who is compassionate, who is loving all the time. That's what you're encountering with the Buddha. And sometimes these communications that go on are so profound, you know, to the people coming along, that they feel, that they experience, that they undergo a very, very deep transformation. It's like there's a complete kind of revolution in their consciousness, in the deepest part of their consciousness. Life is just not the same anymore through this communication. It could be the teaching, say, of the Four Noble Truths, or about impermanence, or the Buddha opening up the path in all its glory to people, or talking about enlightenment. Whatever it is, there's something that happens and it brings about this deep and profound revolution in the base, as it's called in later Buddhism, in the sort of base of consciousness. And it must have been, you know, when these things first happen, an incredibly profound experience for people, because you find it actually becomes a sort of stock passage in the scriptures. But originally, this must have been somebody's real experience, because what they do is they experience, as the text say, their Dharma eye opening. They see the truth directly. They see the way things are unmediated. Somehow, in that moment of communication, they see it, whatever the teaching is, impermanence or whatever it is, and they see a path opening up to them. But then it's really interesting. They break into poetry. They can only express their experience in metaphor. So they say things like, it's as if that which had been knocked down is now set up straight, you know, like a pillar, a great pillar perhaps, has been knocked over, and now that pillar is straight. It's erect, it's firm, it's as it should be. Something is as it should be now. Before it was broken, before it was cast down, now it's established, it's strong. So that's the first thing they say. And then they say, it's as if a way had been shown to one who was lost. So this feeling of doubt and confusion and not knowing where they were and where they were going, and somehow through this communication there is a clear path. There is a clear pathway. And you can imagine, this is quite a profound thing in ancient India, covered as it was with the Mahavana, the great forest, the great wood, the great jungle this image of a way in the wilderness, a way, a clear way, a clear path, would have been a very profound way of describing experience. And it's as if they said, a lamp has been lit in the darkness so that those with eyes can now see. So before it was dark, it was confused, you know, they couldn't see, you know, what was in front of them, and now a lamp is lit and they can see clearly now. So they say these things and you read them again and again, but they never cease to move me, those particular kind of metaphors. Perhaps, you know, in you know, those of you who've connected very strongly with the Dharma, maybe you have your own metaphors and similes, your own sort of poetry to describe that experience. And it's very important to connect with that, to connect with that kind of quality of experience where you started to see the Dharma opening up for you. But having said that they've seen the way things are, they then said, to the Buddha for refuge I go, to the Dharma for refuge I go, to the Sangha for refuge I go, as long as breath lasts, I go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. So this is really, really so significant, that this phrase, going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, was originally an act of very profound, as the expression of a very profound spiritual experience, a very, very profound change. And down the centuries, this idiom of going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha becomes the typical way of describing commitment to the Buddhist path. And it's actually the centre of our entire order. Our ordination ceremonies all happen around this act of going for refuge. Sangharakshita, our teacher and founder, regards it as the central act in the Dharma life. It's what defines all Buddhists. All Buddhists meet in and through the act of going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And it's very important to reflect on these early experiences. Not a ceremony, it's not a formula, it's not some, you know, Buddhist ceremonial, a bit of chanting. It's the expression of this revolution in consciousness, this shift from one dimension to another dimension, this shift in life. And I want to, before going any further, to try and just unpack a little bit this language of going for refuge, because it's a rather odd idiom. It has to be said, even the phrase going for refuge, I mean, it almost doesn't sound quite right in English. But that is an exact translation of the Pali and the Sanskrit. Buddham saranam gacchami means to the Buddha for refuge, I go. And gacchami is an emphatic, you know, you are really going towards that refuge. But when the language of going for refuge, you know, comes up, people often say, I don't like the language of going for refuge. I don't like this language of refuge at all. It makes it sound as though you're an escapist. Why would you go for refuge to something? It makes you sound as though you're weak if you have to go for refuge to something. And isn't it turning the Buddha into a god and his teaching into a dogma and his community, his Sangha, into a sort of group of priests? I want to get away from all that way of looking at things. But I don't think we can really do that. You know, and sometimes people say, well, can't we modernise Buddhism and get rid of the refuges, get rid of that language? But we can't really do that because, well, refuge is something, strangely enough, we're looking for all the time. There's a something in here in the Dhammapada from the section on the Buddha, on the enlightened one. I'll just read it to you. Many people, out of fear, flee for refuge to sacred hills, woods, groves, trees and shrines. In reality, this is not a safe refuge. In reality, this is not the best refuge, fleeing to such a refuge, one is not released from all suffering. You know, and we can all think, yeah, well, probably people did do that in ancient India. They'd go to groves and shrines and hills, kind of magic places, and where the gods were, the local spirits, and these would be places that would, where you'd get blessing, where you'd get protection, where you could perhaps pray for help in, you know, family life, freedom from disease, success in business. I've lived for many years in India, and you know, there are many shrines like this all over the place, and temples, and of all the different religions and traditions. And we can think, well, I don't do that, so you know, this isn't really an issue for me. But the act of searching and trying to find refuge is fundamental to human life, I would say. One of the things that people are very, very concerned about is a feeling of security, of feeling all right, of feeling okay. We're often looking for a kind of permanence, for a kind of safe place, something to go to that will give us, yes, protection, psychological protection, physical protection, that will give us meaning, that will give us happiness. And that's a completely legitimate search, to search for something that's going to give us those things. But it's worth doing a little look at ourselves and a little bit of reflection to ask ourselves, the things I look to make me feel all right, do they actually work? Do they actually make me feel okay? Just on a sort of banal level, you know, sometimes, you know, you can be feeling a bit low and down or whatever, a bit bored. So what to do? Oh, I know, let's just go into Norwich and go shopping. You know, that'll make me feel better. That would cheer me up. I'm sure none of you do that here, being a very edified Buddhist community. But some people really do that. Or if it's not into Norwich, we'll open the computer, let's have a look on Amazon, see if there's any stuff I can get or download or whatever it might be. But there's so many things in our life where we're actually looking to make ourselves feel all right. If it's not actual things outside, it will be in particular behaviours, in particular kind of responses to other people. Do they work? Are they actually helping? So the language of refuge is really getting us to ask ourselves, you know, what am I looking for in this life? What am I searching for? What am I doing with my life? Where am I looking? Where am I finding meaning? Where am I finding satisfaction? Where am I finding safety? All those sorts of questions. Very, very deep, fundamental questions. And are they actually working? Are they actually working? Particularly, are they working when things get really difficult? When things get a bit tough? It's okay, they seem to be working when everything's going okay. But supposing, for example, we lose somebody that we love very much. Something like that. Somebody we love very, very deeply. And for one reason or another, we can't have any connection with them anymore. That ends. What happens? What happens? Are we kind of thrown by that? Are we just devastated by that? Does our life lose all meaning, all purpose, all safety? Or is that horrible feeling of dread, of I'm losing meaning here, a proper's kind of gone out of my life? I mean, if that's so, well, that person and the whole way in which we've had to them we've turned them into a refuge, but they haven't actually given us what we're looking for. Our happiness, our satisfaction, our sense of meaning has been dependent on that person and a particular kind of relationship with that person. Could be anything. Could be a loss of a job, could be, I don't know, anything you like, or a kind of crisis that comes on, perhaps through because of health or something like that, or just changes in life. Suddenly we find our ground has gone, if you like. What we thought was sort of safe and secure and meaningful, that's not there anymore. So that thing that we've been involved with, and the way we've been involved with it, is not a safe refuge. It's not a secure refuge. As I say, it's okay to search for a refuge. I mean, I want to feel okay. I really do want to feel okay. I want to feel confident. I want to feel safe. I want to feel in touch with meaning and value. I want to have a sense of purpose. We all want that. We all want that kind of life. We want happiness in the end, satisfaction. But we have to ask ourselves, where can we really find that? And what we can we do to really find that? So to say to the Buddha, for refuge I go, is extraordinarily profound, because it's touching on something so basic to human life. So basic. It's something really fundamental that's happening, that shift in consciousness. And those old, ancient goers for refuge, those old Buddhists — they wouldn't be called Buddhists in those days, that's a kind of modern term — whatever they were, those old disciples of the Buddha, are saying that there's something really fundamental that they found in the Buddha. Something really fundamental that they found in the Buddha. And it's not just the actual person of the Buddha. This is really important, because somehow in the communication, the Buddha would have communicated that what he is in touch with, what he is, that enlightenment, Bodhi, the fullness of wisdom and compassion, that's not, as it were, personal to him. It's not just to do with his person. It's something that he's attained, that he's realised, you know, through his own practice, through his own effort. So there's a kind of understanding in that act of going for refuge that this is what I can be. This is what I can become. This fullness of wisdom and compassion that's before them is seen as something that they can move towards. They even have a, perhaps will have a sense that, you know, this is the actual fulfillment of human life. This is the actual fulfillment of human life. Human life, in the end, unfolds into Buddhahood, into enlightenment. So that very, very strong sense of a potential being activated, these people would have had. And then the Dhamma as refuge. Well, the Dhamma as refuge is the truth, the way things are. It's not just the sort of teachings, the different practices and the doctrines. It's the actual truth. It's the way things really are. This is a very, very important point about the Buddha's Dharma. It's not, mustn't think of, you know, Buddhism or the Dharma as a sort of constructed religion. What the Buddha points to is always what's right before us, what's right in front of our eyes. You know, impermanence, you know, which is one of the most fundamental teachings. You don't need to do a theology degree or a philosophy degree to get impermanence. You just have to observe. You just have to look deeply and deeply at your experience. And that's where the Buddha begins. Always he begins with experience. So you go for refuge to that, to the Dharma as the truth. Yes, you will also take up the practices that go with that. And then there's the Sangha, the community. The community of the Buddha's disciples. You want to... They're a refuge too, but in particular, the Sangha that people have in mind is the Sangha of those who've realised the truth, what are known as the Arya Sangha, those people, those beings who have real Dharma quality, if you like, substantial Dharma quality, who are really reliable, if you like. But there's also a sense in going for refuge to the Sangha that you will be participating in that. You will be part of that community. You will also be creating that community. This is very, very important in the act of going for refuge in the early days of the Sangha. It's also the act and the expression of discipleship, of joining a community, of being part of a spiritual community. And taking up, if you like, your responsibilities in that community. In some senses, going for refuge to the Sangha is about turning yourself into a refuge, making yourself absolutely spiritually reliable, and to be spiritually reliable, you have in the end to see the truth, the way things are. So going for refuge is something really fundamental, really basic. And, it's why it's so central in our movement and why we have this refuge tree, which I'll come to in a moment. But I want to just stay with the Buddha. So having talked about the early activity of going for refuge, I want to stay with the Buddha, really, a bit longer. It's very hard for us when we, it's well worth reading the old Buddhist texts, and especially if you can be taken through them by good study group leaders, and you've got some very good study group leaders here in the Nori Sangha. Ask them to do days on, the Pali Canon and things like that, and get them to really evoke the scene for you. But one of the things that it's really important to remember is what it was like for the disciples of the Buddha to be around the Buddha. You have to understand that this man was their teacher, their spiritual friend, their guide, their example, their living example. He is the living presence of enlightenment. Yes, he had his own enlightened disciples, and it must have been a very, very special thing in the early days of the Sangha to be around a community of very, very substantial spiritual beings. But before we dwell on that, let's not get too carried away. We also have to acknowledge, and I'm very pleased that the Buddhist scriptures do this, that in the early days, people were just like us. They squabbled and fought, not the enlightened disciples of the Buddha, of course, but everybody else. Or a lot, you had terrible sort of divisions and selfishness and meannesses going on between people. It's all recorded in the Buddhist texts, which personally I find very reassuring. When I see what we can get up to in our own sangha sometimes. It wasn't that, in the old days they were all wonderful and we were all sort of fallen. It's not like that. But to come back to the Buddha's presence was really extraordinary to people. I've already told you that he could be absolutely magnetic for people. I mean, there's a wonderful story, one of my favourite stories, of a disciple named Vakali. I really like Vakali for some reason. And Vakali was a young man who lived in the city of Shravasti. And he saw the Buddha one day. He wasn't interested in a Dharma life. He saw the Buddha one day and basically he fell in love with him. I mean, he just completely lost it. He just got completely infatuated. Just couldn't stop thinking about the Buddha, this really beautiful man. And he thought, well, what am I going to do? The only thing I can do is become a monk. So I can just hang around him all day long. So, I mean, it does seem bizarre, doesn't it? But, I mean, that's what he felt. So he becomes a monk. He becomes a bhikshu. And he spends all his time just hanging around the Buddha and just sort of gazing up at him longingly. To which the Buddha responds in the end by saying, go away, you're not fit to dwell with me. And he goes off into retreat and meditates, and the Buddha comes along and sees him. And there's a lovely verse, a lovely dialogue that Vakali has with the Buddha. The Buddha comes to see him. And Vakali suffered most of his life with stomach trouble, with illness, which he eventually died of. But the Buddha says to him when he sees him in retreat, stricken by sharp stomach pains, you monk, dwelling in the forest grove, where it is harsh and hard to get food, what will you do? And Vakali replies, flooding the body with abundant rapture and bliss, and enduring what is harsh, I shall dwell in the grove. Developing the bases of mindfulness, the faculties, the powers, and the factors of enlightenment, I shall dwell in the grove. Recollecting men and women who are resolute, who put forth energy, constantly firm in their effort, who are harmonious and united, I shall dwell in the grove. Recollecting the perfect Buddha, the foremost, the self-tamed, the perfectly composed and concentrated, with untiring effort, both day and night, I shall dwell in the grove. Really beautiful, inspiring verses. But the last verse, recollecting the perfect Buddha. Recollecting the perfect Buddha. This seems to have been a really important practice in the early days of the Sangha. People being away from the Buddha would bring him to mind, would recollect him, would bring him up into their consciousness, would, if you like, meditate on him. Is what you do in a way when you have a close friend, isn't it? You know, if you have a really close friend who you care for very, very deeply, even when you're away from them, you bring them to mind. You don't, they're not just out of sight, out of mind. You bring them to mind, and that sense of them can uplift you. Well, this is really what's going on with these disciples of the Buddha, but it's with the greatest of friends. They bring the Buddha to mind. They're away from him, but they want to stay in contact with that enlightened presence. And this is a very, very natural human thing to do, to bring to mind a spiritual friend in this way. I was very, very struck by this many, many years ago in India. I went to stay with went on a lecture tour of South Maharashtra, and I was staying with a very old disciple of Sangharakshita, an order member named Shakyanand, who at that time, he died some years ago, but he was the fattest order member in the world. And he was a very, very beautiful man, actually. He was a very, very loving man. People loved very, very deeply. Not a very educated man, very simple man. Hadn't had a lot of contact with Sangharakshita, had been ordained by him. And he was staying in this house. He had part of a room in this house. And he said to me, order members, by the way, have weekly chapter meetings of the local order. And he said to me and my interpreter, an order member named Bodhi Sen, he said, Padmavajra Bodhi Sen, this is where I have my chapter meeting every week. And he sat down, and opposite him was a cushion. And we said, oh, Shakyanand, how can you have a chapter meeting every week? There are no other order members in Kolhapur, where we were. He said, every week Sangharakshita comes and he sits there and we have a chapter meeting. And this wasn't weird, he wasn't mad, it was the most natural human expression of love, devotion, faith. He really was having a meeting with his teacher every week. And I understood in that moment what it must have been like for those disciples of the Buddha, those early disciples of the Buddha. Bringing the Buddha to mind was so natural. It wasn't a meditation exercise. It wasn't a technique. It was what you did. It was what you did. You love your teacher. Your teacher embodied your spiritual goal for you. Naturally, you bring them to mind. And it seems after the Buddha's death, this carried on after the Buddha's parinirvana. This naturally carried on. There's a beautiful story about Ananda. After the parinirvana, he goes to the Jeta Grove, to where the Buddha used to stay, the Gundakuti, as it's called, the perfume chamber. And Ananda, of course, was the Buddha's, for the last 20 years of the Buddha's life, he was the Buddha's attendant, very close friend of the Buddha. And he goes to the Gundakuti and he sweeps out all the old garlands that had been offered to the Buddha. That had withered and so on. People would often bring flowers and adorn the place. And he set up the Buddha's seat and he put out fresh water and he sat there as if the Buddha was still there, was still present. A later commentator says because of his excessive attachment, but I disagree with that later commentator. I would say no, his excessive faith in the Buddha, of course you're going to bring to mind the person that you know that embodies the spiritual ideal for you. That is the most natural thing to do. How else are you going to think of enlightenment? It's not going to be as an idea. It's going to be in that person. You're going to have a sense of that presence of the wisdom and compassion of the Buddha. That is the most natural thing in the world. And it seems that this is something that developed very, very strongly after the Buddha's parinirvana. A lot of the focus of people's recollection of the Buddha was on the stupas. The stupas are these sort of architectural, these monuments where portions of the relics of the Buddha and the great disciples were. People would feel a sense of connection with the Buddha. But as time went on, you also found emerging actual images of the Buddha. Early on, there's no image. Early on, it seems what you have are symbols of the Buddha. So you'll have the Bodhi tree and a sort of space in front of the Bodhi tree, carved as a sort of relief. You know, and that's enough for people to have a sense of the Buddha. That will be a very, very powerful reminder of the enlightened presence. You don't sort of fill the space. But human nature being what it is, and our personhood being very, very important to us, in time, people wanted to make images and paint paintings of the Buddha. I think this is, you know, sometimes people see this as a sort of degeneration. I mean, the early orientalist, you know, translators of Buddhist texts sort of see this as a sort of terrible falling away. You know, the Buddha was obviously a good Protestant, you know, against, you know, rites and rituals and ceremonies and all the rest of it. So he wouldn't have approved of images being turned into a god and all that sort of thing. But, you know, that isn't really what's going on. What's really going on is it is to do with human nature. Like I said, our personhood is extraordinarily important to us. And it sounds a very odd way of putting it, but if you think about it, we are persons, you know, with this human shape and, you know, this human consciousness. And we are extraordinarily important to ourselves. I know some people don't like themselves and all that sort of thing, but we are very important to ourselves. We really matter. You know, and our whole way of looking at life is related to this human shape and this personhood. So to endow your highest spiritual ideal, enlightenment itself, with personhood, is to endow it with the highest possible category that you've got. You know, we say that, you know, there's, you know, Buddhism's about not self and all this sort of thing. But we have to be very, very careful with these sorts of doctrines that we don't end up dehumanizing ourselves and dehumanizing our experience and losing our humanness, losing our personhood. It's very, very important not to do that. Very important not to do that with the Buddha and the Buddhist tradition. So the emergence of Buddha images, the emergence of Buddhist art, if you like, paintings and so on, is you're seeing enlightenment in the highest possible category. It's there before you, if you like. And of course, this really did take off, this whole emergence of the Buddha image, you know, throughout India and wherever Buddhism went. You find Buddhist images of the Buddha all over the Buddhist world. I mean, not only that, you get other figures, you know, through the mysteries of history that we'll never really ever get to grips with and understand. You get all sorts of other figures starting to emerge. It's as though what's happening is people are sort of, if you like, well, who knows really what's happening? It's they're having some sort of visionary experience, if you like, or some sort of experience, some sort of insight, some sort of, you know, lived experience of enlightenment, and they're seeing that as something that's just efflorescing, that's just incredibly creative, that's just sort of opening up, and they're seeing that enlightenment just has so many different dimensions. I mean, for a start, enlightenment is vast. The Buddha's enlightenment experience is vast. The Buddha said in his own day when he's being asked about his nature, he says something like, it's impossible to comprehend the Tathagata. It's like trying to comprehend the great and mighty ocean. It's that deep and it's that vast. Enlightenment really doesn't have, well, oceans have a boundary, don't they? But, you know, an enlightened consciousness has no boundary. Even to call it a consciousness isn't right. So, of course, as Buddhists down the ages meditated more and more deeply on the nature of enlightenment, they start seeing more in it. More opens up, and that starts to get depicted. It starts to get seen as all sorts of Buddhas and all sorts of figures, and this is, yes, why you get all this material, but it's all coming out of the Buddha's enlightenment experience. And it's very important to relate whatever figure that emerges, that you come across in Buddhist tradition, back to the Buddha, back to the Buddha's enlightenment experience. That's the seed, if you like, of it all. Like a very famous image, of course, is Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. That is an attempt to express the Buddha's compassion, the Buddha's tenderness, the Buddha's response to suffering in that particular image, in that particular form. Of course, it grew up out of particular cultural circumstances, through the particular experience of people in a particular time, a particular place. But that's what it is. It's seeing, it's having a sort of experience, if you like, of the Buddha's compassion in this particular form, as a being, as a person, as a myth, if you like. So we've got all this imagery. Not only have we got all this imagery of the Buddha, of course, the Dharma, the Buddha's teaching, also developed down the centuries. The Buddha's Dharma has always responded to changing circumstances and conditions. It developed in India. It had all sorts of phases in India. Some of those phases, you know, we don't even know about, because they're only fragmentary, because, you know, they've been lost. It developed in Tibet. It developed in China. It developed in Southeast Asia. There was a very, very important phase of Buddhism in Central Asia, which we know next to nothing about, including Iran, which we're only beginning to sort of find out things about. And that Dharma teaching has flowed down through the ages, and it's come now into the modern era, into the West, into Norwich, even. The Dharma's come down to us in all sorts of forms, in all sorts of ways, and it can be completely overwhelming when if you first start getting into Buddhism and you start exploring different traditions and so on, you can think, well, what is this thing called Buddhism? There seem to be so many contradictions, so many different ways of going about things. So it's very important that we find and we search for not just Buddhism generally, but a particular way of practicing the Buddha Dharma, a way of practicing the teaching. And of course, that's what this centre's for. Yes, it's a place to practice Buddhism. It's a place to practice the Dharma. But it's coming to us in a particular way, in a particular form, transmitted through Sangharakshita and Sangharakshita's disciples and his disciples. This is, if you like, taking that vast stream of the Dharma, going back to the Buddha and applying it to our particular circumstances, giving us a particular path, a particular way in. And it's very important to find a particular path, a particular way in. You can get very lost and very confused. You need at a certain point, if you like, to decide on a particular way. If you like, you need to decide to go for refuge. And going for refuge means following a particular approach, a particular tradition. There's a Zen saying, if you want to fill up the bucket, put the bucket right down into the well. until it's really full. Don't just take it a little bit and then take it out and then go somewhere else. Put it right down into the well. Go through a particular path so that you can go to the depth of things. And when you do that, whatever path it is, you can make sense of the whole tradition. You know, if you go in one way. So this refuge tree, I better come on to this now because I've been talking for quite a while and we really don't want to go on all night. So I want to talk about this refuge tree because actually that's what it's describing. It's describing Sangharakshita's vision of the Buddhist tradition. And it's describing our whole, if you like, relationship to it. I'll say a little bit about the history of this particular image before talking a bit about the image. Probably not in a lot of detail because you'll be following it up in the coming weeks. First of all, this whole notion of a refuge tree comes from Tibetan Buddhism. In Tibetan Buddhism, I don't know when this particular tradition of doing this started, but at a certain point in Tibetan Buddhist tradition, there developed a whole training system of what they call preliminary practices. I mean, when you look at the preliminary practices, they're pretty hardcore, I have to say, having done them. Well, they're not really preliminary at all. But one of these preliminary practices, I won't say what they're preliminary to, one of these preliminary practices is a going for refuge practice. They really want to make sure in that tradition that going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha is powerfully alive in you. And what there emerged were these visions that, if you like, that the tradition develops of a refuge tree. You have a central figure, it could be the Buddha, it could be the founder of a particular tradition, like Padmasambhava, if you were a follower of the Nyingmapa school, and there would be the teachers of that lineage, there would be all sorts of deities of different kinds associated with practices that you're going to take up. And what you have to do is visualize it in a blue sky. You have to see it in your imagination. You chant a verse expressive of your going for refuge to all that, image that embodies the refuges. And then you do a full-length prostration, throwing yourself full down flat on the ground. And you have to do lots and lots of these. They say 100,000. But the idea is that you just go on doing them. One of Sangharakshita's teachers said that he hadn't done as many prostrations as he would have liked. He'd only managed 800,000 in his life. And the whole idea is that you're making going for refuge a spiritual practice in its own right, involving your entire body, speech and mind. Your mind is imagining the refuges, your speech is saying a verse to the refuges, your body is going down, is prostrating again and again, expressing your commitment to the refuges. And Sangharakshita was, took up one of these traditional Tibetan practices when he was in India. And he found it very, very useful, very, very helpful in a particular Tibetan tradition. And he taught us that practice when he came to the West. I did the practice that he did for many, many years. And I got an enormous amount out of it. Because I was quite young when I started it, I was doing lots and lots of these prostrations, which I was very, very glad to do. Very, very good thing to do. But back in about the late 80s, early 90s, we started to do training retreats for people who'd asked for ordination. And we introduced this practice, this refuge tree practice. But there was a feeling that there was a kind of, it was a bit incongruous. There we were, doing something which was to do with, in some ways, a quite obscure Tibetan tradition. But actually, the centre of our tradition was the Buddha. So out of that, Sangharakshita composed a new refuge tree. Not just with the Buddha at the centre, but with teachers from different parts of the Buddhist tradition, as well as himself with his teachers and various other figures. So now, this is the image that people who've asked for ordination and order members will visualise and prostrate to when they do this practice. And it's a much more direct practice and does actually describe much more fully, much more clearly what we're doing. So I want to say a bit, maybe I should say a bit about the tree itself. Maybe I'll just run through the practice for you to give you a sort of bit of a taster of what goes on. So you would sit for meditation to begin with this practice. And then what you do is imagine a vast expanse of clear blue sky in all directions. You sort of almost vanish into the sky. So this is said to symbolise shunyata, emptiness, the fact that there's no solid, fixed and unchanging elements anywhere in existence. Everything is wide open, a vast space. But this isn't a sort of blank, dead space. You have to sort of imagine it as sort of, you know, almost vibrating, you know, with potential. And out of that, they're kind of formed. Something starts to form. You start to imagine, you start to feel and see a rainbow-coloured cloud, if you can imagine such a thing. You do get them. I've seen them above Padmaloka. A rainbow-coloured cloud forms. So that's the first thing. And then out of that rainbow-coloured cloud, there emerges a gigantic white lotus, like a sort of tree. It's like, you know, like what's that? Like Jack and the Beanstalk. I don't know why I think that. I always do when I do this bit of it. Anyway, this thing goes up, and this great big lotus unfolds in front of you. And of course, there's all sorts of symbolism here. I'm not going to try and unpack the symbolism, but, you know, the lotus is an incredibly important symbol in Buddhist tradition. It's obviously a symbol of growth, of spiritual rebirth and purity and transformation. And you then see seated on that lotus the Buddha, the very fount and origin of the tradition, the very embodiment of enlightenment. So there he is, right at the centre of things. I should just say, you're instructed when you imagine these things, you're not supposed to see them as opaque and as flat. You're trying to see them as though they're made of light, that they're like a rainbow, they're like, that they're translucent. That's what you're trying to do. And the training here, I should just say, is that's how you're supposed to see everything all the time. Right now, that's the way we should be looking at things. Quite trippy, really, but you're trying to sort of see everything as sort of an expression of emptiness. So you see the Buddha, and then you have, maybe I'll stand up, you see these two figures. So you have the Buddha, he's, as it were, our Buddha, the Buddha of our time, and this Buddha is Dipankara, a light bringer, who, according to sort of Buddhist legend and mythology, is a Buddha of the dim and distant non-historical past. On the other side, you've got Maitreya, the Buddha of the future, who will rediscover the Dharma long after the Buddha's Dharma, our Buddha's Dharma, has been lost, isn't even a memory anymore. So obviously the symbolism here is that enlightenment is transcends time, and it's always a possibility. The potentiality for enlightenment, of the way being discovered and shown, is always there, in the distant past, in the far future, and right now. So Shakyamuni, our Buddha, Dipankara, Maitreya. And then when you're doing the practice, you then imagine lotuses unfolding in the four directions around the lotus, and in front you see Sangharakshita and his main teachers, the different teachers. I won't mention all their names.
I should just say it's very, very important not to sort of think that Sangharaksh is a sort of megalomaniac and he's put himself on the tree, you know, because he wants everybody to bow down to him. That's not what's going on here. The symbolism is that his teaching and the teaching that you receive from his disciples is our way into the Dharma. He's our way into all of this. It's like this is a doorway into this vast refuge tree, if you like, all these teachings, you know. So this centre is a doorway into, you know, the whole of the Buddha Dharma. I should just say something about, now I won't say something about prostration, I'll do that in a minute, but so these are Sangharaksha and these teachers. Then you see on this side the great Bodhisattvas. So this is the Arya Sangha, the disciples of the Buddha, the noble spiritual community of the Bodhisattvas. This is looking at the Sangha in a way kind of out of time. They're all young and beautiful, 16-year-olds, Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, Manjugosha, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, Vajrapani, the Bodhisattva of energy, Tara, the Bodhisattva, who is the very quintessence of compassion, and also known as the quick way to wisdom. And then Kshitigarbha, who has this unusual form. He's not wearing silks and jewels. He's wearing this monk's robe and holding this staff. He's a kind of perpetual wanderer, Kshitigarbha, and his particular symbolism is that he goes down into the hells, he goes down into the darkest of places and brings people back. And Sangharaksha was asked, why have we got Kshitigarbha on our refuge tree? Because it was unusual. No, it wasn't a bodhisattva that we were that familiar with. And he said, well, sometimes there's a need for us to go down into hell, sometimes our own and sometimes other people's, and come back with them, with ourselves. And on the other side of the refuge tree, you've got the great Arahant disciples of the Buddha. So these are his actual living disciples. So this is like the spiritual community in time. Sometimes the Arahants are depicted with really sort of old and lined faces. It's sort of enlightenment in time, in the human realm. And then above here, sort of, or rather, let's go behind before we go above, on the lotus behind, you've got all these scriptures, you've got all these teachings of the Buddha. They're all books. I think there are even some ring binders there that are local. So, yeah, I think they're suspiciously like that. Box files, I think, piled up there, as well as sort of traditional wrapped books. I think he did that. So it's a very modern refuge tree. And of course, this symbolises the Dharma, you know, the teaching of the Buddha, all of the teachings of the tradition. In principle, you know, it's all of the great teachings of the Buddha are what we go for refuge to. And then above, yes, you've got, you know, sort of adorning the sky here, you've got the great teachers of the Buddhist tradition. I mean, not every single one of them. There are so many great teachers in the Buddhist tradition. But of all the schools, you've got Indian teachers of different schools. You've got Tibetan teachers of different schools. You've got Chinese teachers of different schools. You've got Japanese teachers of different schools. They wouldn't actually appear together normally. And this is one of the things we have to sort of realise about Buddhism in the West. You know, Buddhism is having to talk to itself like it's never done before, because all of the Buddhist schools actually developed in complete isolation, even in polemical isolation to one another. We live in a very different era now where there's so much more communication. We need to be aware of all that. It's not necessarily that we're going to follow all of those teachings that they give. I mean, if we did, we'd probably end up a bit schizophrenic, you know, trying to, you know, this is Hakuin, the great koan master, self-power master of, you know, really getting down to some pretty tough, hardcore koan meditation. Incredible life, Hakuin. The other side is Shinran. It's all other power, giving up to Amitabha. Well, try and do those both. You're going to have a bit of trouble. But what you have are inspiring lives. incredibly inspiring lives. But also some of these, you know, great teachers, their actual texts we do use, like Shantideva, who's in the middle at the top there, if you can see him, his Bodhicharyavatara, Entering the Path of Enlightenment, is an absolutely wonderful text on the Bodhisattva path. You have to work at it to extract its Dharma essence, its spiritual essence. But it's a really wonderfully inspiring text, and it's the basis of our Sevenfold Puja that we practice regularly. And then above, you've got, well, you've got the mandala of the five Buddhas, Varochana, Amitabha, Acobhya, Ramasambhava, Amoghasiddhi. So this is, like I was saying earlier, these, you know, five Buddhas, this five Buddha mandala is a, gives us a wonderful way of meditating on enlightenment, on the realm of enlightenment. There's all sorts of symbolism associated with these five Buddhas, you know, inexhaustible symbolism, really. And above, higher still, sort of above and behind, is Vajrasattva, the adamantine being. He's a Buddha, sometimes called the primordial Buddha, who appears in Bodhisattva form. And he sort of embodies the absolute purity of enlightenment, the purity of reality itself, of shunyata. In a way, he is the sort of the figure that's sort of nearest, if you like, to the clear blue sky from a certain point of view. Then all around, you've got these are here, you've got gods and goddesses making all sorts of offerings, you know, to the tree. So you see all this, well, you try to imagine all this. And you imagine these, you know, these beautiful gods and goddesses, devas and devis, making fabulous offerings to the tree. So this is the refuge tree that you're trying to imagine. Yes, you're trying to imagine the Buddha and the whole stream of the Dharma as it's come down to you. That's what you're doing in this practice. And then holding that image, you would then get up and you would, after saying some verses of aspiration beforehand, you would get up and you would chant, actually, Om Ahum, to the best of all refuges I go. And then you would prostrate, silently saying, to the Buddha for refuge I go, to the Dharma for refuge I go, to the Sangha for refuge I go. And then you get up and you do it again and again and again and again and again, for however you want to do it. Just say something about prostrating. It is a very strong thing to do, but again, and sometimes people, I've had some very strange conversations with some people about some of the figures on the tree, and people even wonder about Sangharakshita. They say, well, you know, is so and so enlightened? You know, somebody said it about one of Sangharakshita's teachers, the one next to him in yellow, Jagdish Kasha. An order member phoned me up and said, I don't get the impression that he was very spiritually developed. So how can we prostrate to him? And I said, I don't know what you mean. He's one of Sangharakshita's teachers, and, you know, he wants us to, you know, revere him. He revered him, so respected him, so should we. And it got me thinking about the nature of prostration. In the East, bowing and prostrating is a very, very natural form of address. In India, when I'd be travelling with friends, very, very educated people, we'd go to their village and they'd go and see their old mum and dad or grandparents, and they'd do a prostration to them and take the dust from their feet. They absolutely revered their parents. They'd go and see their old teacher in their old school teacher, their Guruji. And again, there would be a prostration. There would be this sense of reverence and gratitude. So it's not that, you know, we have some, I think, quite odd notions with these things in the West. Somehow you need to know the status of somebody, their absolute sort of spiritual status, even their sort of spiritual authority, before you could possibly do that.
I must say, generally in the East, and it can be just a custom, but generally the culture can be much more, you're looking to revere, you want to revere, you want to find people to revere. You want, you know, that's a much more sort of natural mode. Even the Buddha himself, after his enlightenment, was searching in his consciousness for somebody to revere. He said, it's painful, it's dukkha, if a man has no one to revere, no one to look up to, no one to serve, no one to sort of rely on. It's really painful not to have that in life. And it is painful. You know, presumably if we can't find that, we think that we're the absolute pinnacle of existence. Well, what a drag! I mean, if I'm the pinnacle of existence, oh my goodness, what a terrible state of affairs! I mean, the Buddha actually can't find anybody, so but he still wants to revere. So he says, "What I'll do is, I'll revere the Dharma. I'll revere the Dharma that I've discovered." Very, very mysterious statement that I will revere and I will rely on and I will serve the Dharma, and you can see him doing this for the rest of his days. So a prostration is also an expression of really getting in touch with this quality of revering, of really looking up, as well as an expression through your body of commitment, you know, to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. So you do this, it's a wonderful practice because it's an active meditation, if you like. And at the end of it, you sit down again, and there's a lovely thing that then happens. You imagine white light just streaming down from all of this onto you. I've missed out a very important element, actually. And that is, as well as imagining all this, you also imagine either side of you, your father on one side, your mother on the other side. Sometimes you even imagine your father and mother on your shoulders, and all women on one side, all men on the other side, and all living beings whatsoever all around you. In other words, you're imagining all beings prostrating to this refuge tree. And yes, mum and dad as well. They also go for refuge. I mean, the argument seems to be that you know, our conditioning from mum and dad is so strong, is so powerful, they've got to come with us, you know. They have to kind of, at least imaginatively, I mean, in reality, they might not want to. If they, hey, mum and dad, you fancy prostrating? They probably wouldn't be too keen. But, and it's very, very interesting when you do this practice, you know, sometimes people do it, they suddenly start realising there are things they need to resolve in relationship to their parents as they do this practice, or they have the experience of it actually resolving as they do this practice. Very, very powerful. So you're imagining that you're prostrating with all beings when you do this practice. And yes, at the end you imagine this sort of white light pouring down, just purifying you of all faults, of all, you know, anything that sort of, any barriers between you and going for refuge, you and living a full, you know, Dharma life, a full spiritual life. You know, there's something about the act of commitment which sets up a purification. You have to experience that. And then at the end, after that, you imagine it all dissolving away into the Buddha, into the central figure. It all goes back to the Buddha. Everything goes back into the Buddha. You know, just to remind us completely that the Buddha is where it all comes from. Enlightenment is where it all comes from, where it all goes back to. The goal of the spiritual life, of the Dharma life. And then the Buddha disappears into the clear blue sky, and then the clear blue sky itself fades away. So it's an amazing practice, this. You go through a whole sort of, in a way, drama. You kind of live in a much more mythic plane. You're doing a sort of imaginal yoga when you do this practice. And the imaginal yoga and the myth that you're part of is to do with the very meaning of life itself. The very meaning of life itself. what you're experiencing in a practice like this is the act of going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha on every single level. On every single level, from the highest level, the Buddha, in a sense, goes for refuge. Sangharakshita calls it the ultimate going for refuge. The Buddha is enlightened. His disciples go for refuge on a lower level, and we are going for refuge on our level. All of life is going for refuge. Sangharakshita has this sort of vision that all of life, in some mysterious way, is involved in self-transcendence. He did say that this is an impossibly poetic vision, but that is his vision, that all of life has in it the potential, and even to some extent the activity, the urge towards self-transcendence. He once said the Bodhisattva principle, the Bodhisattva being the being of wisdom and compassion, the Bodhisattva principle is present in all of life. Wherever a kind and intelligent act is performed, wherever a kind and intelligent act is performed, there you have the very seed of enlightenment. Doesn't matter how minimal that kindness, intelligence is, or however low level it is, that is the seed of Buddhahood itself. That is the seed of evolution. That is the seed of spiritual development. It's the seed that brings about transformation. So when you're doing this practice, you're becoming more conscious of that. You're making yourself more conscious of that seed of wisdom and compassion in all of life, which finds its expression in this image. And the image is only a doorway. The image is only a doorway. There is, as it were, a real refuge tree. Doesn't look like that. It doesn't look like that. This is a doorway into something unimaginable. So when you really get into this practice, well, all sorts of things, you know, start opening up. I mean, Arloka, you know, my dear friend Arloka, when he used to lead retreats which were devoted entirely to this practice, he put up this refuge tree, and he'd say, "What's this?" And somebody would say, "A refuge tree," and he said, "Wrong." And they'd keep trying, and somebody would say, "It's a painting." Yeah. Ah, well done. And so this comes in a particular form because of where we are, how we are at our place in this time, in this place. And this time in this place is important, but it's opening up into, you know, dimensions that you can't in the end depict. And there I will stop. Thank you.